Thank you.
Okay, this is interviewing Nandita, 7 September 1971 at Green Bank.
When I was at NRL from 1951 to 55, a lot of exciting things went on that are pretty historical at this point. One of them was the discovery of the hydrogen ion absorption in the spectra of bright sources. This all sounds quite simple now as I say it, but at the time we had found only a few bright sources, more or less by stumbling on them. There was no background to this. At NRL, those sources were discovered at around 21 centimeters, 20 centimeters actually. At about the same time that these sources were discovered in the continuum, they were doing a hydrogen line survey of the plane. Ed McLean had worked up a recording system, of course an analog recorder at that point, which he thought was very clever, and indeed it was, in which one could record the continuum and the line at the same time, effectively looking at a window and the signal channel at the same
frequency
time.
Frequency switching, really.
Yeah. And so he had the two parallel pieces of paper, and they began doing a record that they were going to use quite separately, the continuum and the hydrogen line. And when the continuum went up, the hydrogen line went down, and everybody was totally surprised. Perhaps one of the...
You were looking for emission, in other words.
Yeah, they weren't related. It was just that we could get two things at once, not that they would be related. And he, of course, thought something was wrong with his recording system. I think the impression one gets from reading literature is that these discoveries were all made by intent. It's my feeling that it's mostly by chance.
Yeah.
That stumbling on them and being lucky.
How soon after the Harvard discovery of them, well, Harvard and then verified in Holland and Australia?
Yeah, it wasn't. That was in early 51. I guess this must have been 52 or 3, perhaps.
So
it was quite a long time.
Year.
People, they had... At the time the discovery was made, of course, there wasn't a hydrogen line receiver at NRL. It was developed afterwards. But they had a great head start in doing it because of all their electronics background.
And do you have any idea why the delay in not finding absorption for a couple of years? Or was there not much hydrogen work done at all?
Well, people didn't look in the direction of... Well, in fact, we didn't know about the sources. The survey of... In the continuum was... And that's kind of fun, too. I was out of college and not yet in graduate school. That was a long way in the future, and I was kind of a data reducer. But I had some undergraduate training in astronomy. And we were scanning the sky for sources, scanning the galactic plane to see when the continuum around that region would go up.
Using the NRL 50-foot?
Yes, right. And that was something of a problem with the analog drive and so forth. But and the positions, of course, were very bad. We just come upon a source and then try to pin down as well as we could what the position was. Signal to noise is not what it is today, of course. And we just made a list of them, and we came to... Actually, we found a bright source, which was called NRL number 5, and then we discovered later on that underlying this very bright, sharp peak was... a broader component, which was called NRL number 9, and I was keeping the records for this, and so that I recorded from the output that we had the position, and didn't mean anything to any of the people around there, but it was 17 hours and minus 27 degrees, and I realized it was a galactic center. But that just illustrates the point. Nobody went at this with the intent of what is it in the galactic center. It was exciting to put the two things together afterwards.
Just pretty random searching.
Yeah, and because we didn't know what we were looking for.
You didn't know if you were looking at radio galaxies or something in the galaxy.
The word wasn't invented. It was...
That's right, yeah. Well, Cygnus A was known. That was known,
yes,
to correspond to an analog.
Yes, I think so. Yes,
that,
at that time.
That's
probably
the only example.
But it was colliding galaxies at that
right.
point. It was a very strange object. It wasn't at all clear that there was a large population of these things.
So was this the first detection of Sagittarius A?
Yes. I guess some of the excitement of that time was also in the continuum work that Fred Haddock was doing at short wavelengths. Nobody had done anything other than the sun as short as 10 centimeters, I guess that's what he was doing. But, and in that case, he had a little, and by the time he did that, he had a little better notion of what to do, and so he set out looking at known optical H2 regions. But, of course, signal-to-noise was not what it is today, and I remember the very great excitement that Fred had when he saw the Orion Nebula. Seeing the Orion Nebula now sounds like nothing, and it isn't anything now, but at the time it was as exciting as any discovery is now.
It's like finding a new molecule in the
Orion Nebula.
Even more so than that, even. Cause...
Well, you had less to guess about it.
This was 10 centimeters or so.
Yeah. And that was its first detection also.
Okay, now so you had the absorption. Did you find it in several sources or?
Well, yes. Then they looked at Cygnus and it cast, and then where it was very big indeed. I was somewhat out of it by the time that actually happened. My most intimate contact with it was seeing the two pins go in two different directions.
Right. Now I've heard, and maybe you can straighten me out on this, that NRL. In the first 21st century absorption paper, didn't really understand what they were seeing. In other words, they thought that they didn't realize it was hydrogen in front of a galactic source. That was they didn't understand the nature of absorption relative to that emission. They thought it was a hydrogen source that was doing something.
No, I don't think that's right. I think the original Lilly McLean paper talks about clouds in between to explain the structure. The explanation isn't right, but it's not as wrong as that. That's fine.
I haven't read it.
Some people are so hungry, they can't wait.
Hungry for
knowledge. You're envious.
I'll get you. Well, now, there was, in 55, I guess it was, there's the Lilly McLean paper, which has the equation of radiative transfer and all that.
Yes.
Now, that's a reasonable explanation, but before that.
The Hagen and
Lilly. Yes, before Lilly, I think.
Hagen and McLean. That's right,
because
they were not really
trained in this sort of
thing. That's right. And I think that's correct. And now that you remind me, I think that the original Hagen and McLean thing was not correct. But it's not really surprising. The talent these people brought to it was electronics.
Right.
And that's why they didn't know where the galactic center was. Obviously, Ed Lilly would have known if he'd been there. But
I have to look back at those papers myself. If someone mentioned that to me, that if you look at them, you can see that they really didn't know what they
said.
They just knew it was opposite to emission. But I mean, that's easy. In hindsight, it's easy to check out things like that. So then, after NRL, you went to grad student
at Harvard.
And then to ASCRL, I guess.
Yes.
And then to Berkeley.
Right.
Now, you went to Berkeley just before the OH was discovered.
Not quite. OH was discovered in absorption in November of 1953. I was still at ASCRL then. But I was able, Doc Ewan and I were able to confirm the observation, the detection of OH in absorption at the same time that it was confirmed in Australia and about the same time at Berkeley.
Using an AFCRL dish?
Yes.
And also, Sam Goldstein told me, just for your information, that they confirmed it at Harvard also, at Agassiz, using the Agassiz dish. This may have been a little bit later in time.
Yes, the three papers were published at once.
No, I'm sorry, not a real confirmation. I'm saying they looked at it shortly afterwards. They didn't publish anything.
The three papers appeared in Nature.
On one of the published ones?
Yes.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, Nature had a series of them all at once.
Right.
We were all working at it. And of course, the marvelous story about that is what everybody missed. Because they didn't believe in the baselines of their receivers. All of us missed it. The detection, everything. When, of course, they found it in Cass, and then they also looked at Sagittarius. And so we tried to do both things also, looking avidly and hard for the zero velocity component, which of course is the strongest thing. What we found eventually after a lot of trouble was a very small little blip, something one would have used for confirmation perhaps, but have been pretty nervous about making a detection in the base. So. And everybody had very bad baselines. The receivers were thrown together more or less for this confirmation, especially ours. It's just awful. And then it took the discovery at Harvard later on to show that it wasn't based on at all. It was a little bit of a blip on an enormous feature. And we just didn't have enough faith that if we waited long enough, if we scanned long enough, we would have gone back up again. And in fact, then I guess it was the Australians who discovered the second large feature because Harvard hadn't gone far enough.
Right.
So it's very much concentrating on what you expect. We were expecting a narrow feature near zero. And that's what we saw. Maybe that's a lesson. One sees what one expects.
That's true, too, and other things. Now, on the emission, Did you have ideas when you went to Berkeley about doing a mission?
Yes. In fact, I had, when I was at ASTR, not a mission, but the program that led to it. When I was at ASTR on, after this was, confirmation was done, I got a parametric amplifier and an entirely improved system with the idea of looking for OH interabsorption in front of galactic H2 regions. The reason for that was that at 18 centimeters, they're reasonably strong. And in addition, they are large in angular size, so that a small antenna, a large beam, wouldn't be so handicapped.
Yeah, wouldn't be.
And so that's what I was planning to do. And then in the, quote all of this, but during the time of this, I was getting the receiver together and everything to do it, there was a fire in the front end of the receiver due to some kerosene. And burned up the whole receiver. Not the parametric amplifier, but all of the rest of it was melted. Literally
another historic fire. You know the one about the Dutch fire in 21 centimeters and that. So here we have another one.
And it was, well, it never got back together. Never. Not before I left. I left there in March of 1965, and I struggled all that time to try to get it going. It wasn't a thing they were primarily interested in. I had to scrounge things from everywhere.
Right. How big a ditch was this at
this is 85 feet at 7 miles. Used primarily for ionosphere things, some for the instrument.
Right. Let me just check one thing, please. So when you went out to Berkeley, were you thinking of doing some follow-up OH work?
I was thinking of doing what I was unable to do there. And, of course, that was such an obvious thing to do with a small dish. They had the same idea also. I guess, actually, David Williams and Harold Weaver began the survey, and I was really kind of peripherally connected with it at that point, just more or less an interested bystander. And they saw emission in W49, and it was as surprising as you could imagine.
Yeah.
It shouldn't have gone in that direction. The immediate thing next was, what do we look at second? And I said Orion Nebula. And that wasn't entirely as obvious as it seems now, but that it was appeared to be a good guess. And then, as I told you, after we found some more such peaks and they got to be stranger and stranger, I went to Rudolf Minkowski and said, what would you suggest? What's really a neat place to look next? And he said that he had, during the time of making the Palomar survey, done some photographing that he wasn't really supposed to do. In testing the instrument, he had done some work in the south of the regular survey.
Right.
And in that area that he photographed was this beautiful big H2 region in GC6334. And it looked full of interest to him, and he said, look there. And we did, and it was there that we found some of the most volatile type OH. We certainly found OH emission stronger at 1665 and 67, and it was there that I saw first the variation with time that was so striking.
Okay, now before we get the time variations, I definitely want to go through that, of course, but I want to make sure I have it straight that your program was definitely designed to look in H2 regions right from the start.
Yes.
And how many did you look into before you got to W49? Is that one of the very first ones, do you remember?
Yes, there weren't. Probably not very many, but I can't be certain. I suspect that what happened was that we had the Westerhout catalog and just went down the bright ones.
Yeah.
And the ones that happened to be at the right ascension. There was no sense to it.
Yeah. It's interesting because Goldstein said that they looked in all sorts of things, and then just on a whim, he said, well, let's try H2 regions. It's sort of a different
approach. We had really...
Now, did you know that they were doing this at Harvard?
No.
They were looking... Had a similar program, so you didn't feel any competition there.
Well, now, somewhere toward the end, after we had found it, we heard rumors that they had found something exciting, and so we thought that perhaps it was the same thing, that there was competition in that sense.
Right.
It's hard to reconstruct
when
that.
When did you find the emission? What month was that?
Late May or early June 1965.
65, so they did beat you by 6 months in terms of actually seeing
it. Did they?
According to him, anyway. In November, they saw W49, and
well, they certainly didn't say anything about
it. No, they didn't. I can tell you this. I'm going to have to take this over, at least his version of it. So you picked up the sources that are reported in the first paper in Nature, I guess it is.
Right.
And then when did you become aware of what you thought were time variations?
Well, Very early, because the discovery was made in May, June. And then there was some, I've forgotten what it was now, but there was delay in doing some more observations. And then we picked it up again in mid-July. And that was where the 6334 change was so very apparent. That, of course, is one of the largest changes that we've seen. And one wouldn't believe it on the basis of a single case like that.
Sure.
And in fact, of course, we argued and talked and thought for a long time before we said anything to anybody. But the fact that within the spectra there were features which did not change meant that we could take care of any receiver problems with that. So that
not exactly, of course, because now we know they're highly polarized, and perhaps the polarization characteristics of your receiver. You weren't worrying about that factor at all, probably.
No, but we did at about the same time begin to do polarization measurements. Somebody else had found that they were polarized. Forgotten now who it was, but that wasn't a discovery.
I think that was MIT.
Yeah. We followed that up and included it in a primitive way. It's very primitive compared to what you're doing now. But yes, there are lots of things that could have led us astray. Fortunately, they did vary in time.
When did you become aware that there were two sources in 6334? I forget now. The Apogee supplement has this map with.
Yes, I can't remember exactly, but I know that we. I remember when we saw one of these sources and looked at the picture, it was in a very dark cloud, a dusty region in it, and the notion had already come about that maybe that had something to do with it, with the emission. And so we began looking around 6334 at other dark regions, and that's when it turned up. That's the way I remember it.
Yeah. And so now the other thing that's of interest to me is the reaction to this time variation. I know it wasn't generally believed.
Absolutely not. For more than a year, I guess, I had different reactions. Some of them were aggressively against it, and others were very sweet. One of them was, "I'm really very sorry, Nan, but we don't see any changes," which made me more angry, I suppose, than the other. Well,
were they actually monitoring 6334?
No, they weren't, and we were. That was the, and also Orion. We of course saw variations in Orion too, of a smaller size. That's what I kept saying. Have you looked? When did you look? And people began to look some, but never in a monitoring sense. It was always an occasional look, and always then hard to compare observations because they weren't made at quite the same time. So it was an honest skepticism, all right, which got be rather long drawn out, but the theoreticians were perfectly willing to accept it. They were ready to start spinning theories on this basis and said, "Well, sure, it's an unstable situation."
Yeah.
But the observers said, "Prove it," and of course they're right.
Well, when did it generally become believed? Did someone confirm it? And
yes, it was what makes I think who first told me that he had indeed seen
it
there.
I don't think this was ever Meeks. Paul and Meeks.
I know that he talked. I didn't remember that.
That's right. They have time variations of 6334.
Yes, and he talked about it in a meeting. That's where I.
Yeah, probably an AAS meeting or something.
And then they saw it in Australia too, even after they had said it didn't occur. Well, it's amusing to hear the ease with which the water vapor variations are accepted. Nobody had any fight about that at all.
Yeah, there was a little bit of problem in the first few days, but it was pretty easy
year
after that.
So.
Yeah. In terms of us believing in ourselves.
Well, at that time, things didn't vary on any interstellar medium. That was just not a thing anybody ever considered. It was just too
That's
large
true.
Scale
this is,
and all
this
that.
This is pre-pulsars.
Yes. So there was nothing that varied. And all of a sudden, everything does, including quasars. Yeah. I guess there weren't quasar variations known before.
That's about the discovery of quasars in 64, 65. There may have been no variable radio sources. Maybe Cass A was known to be silent.
Or long, slow change, yes, but not this rapid thing. Yeah.
That's true. Did you didn't really undertake a monitoring program after that.
Were
you?
Yes.
Yes, that's what you did. The after supplement has two or three years.
Right.
I'm sorry, I take that back.
Yes, every minute.
You did look at that.
We also tried finding variations of a very short nature, and that was entirely unsuccessful. One could believe that you saw variations over a period of about a week, but nothing any shorter. And in fact, more recently, some of the students, Richard Hills there, has tried, for example, to see it shorter.
Is he taking tapes out of it?
Yes, and he's about to publish this, I think.
Oh, good.
It's only just really finished, I think, the analysis, and they don't see anything. I don't know to exactly what limit in the reminiscence in connection with ammonia has to do with hearing Charlie Towns talk about the possibility of detection of the molecule and hearing people, having people say to him that it has four atoms in it. There can't be any such, and he was telling me, and he, the physicist that he is, just ignored it. And it was his not being indoctrinated in what the things ought to be in the interstellar medium, he looked. Of course, he has lots of knowledge back of that. But I guess it was shortly after the discovery of the 1-1 line, then they looked for the 2-2 line also as a confirmation. And that, they didn't really expect to find very much, but they found some which suggested that the local temperature was higher than had been expected. So that made it plausible to look for the water, which is such a high-lying line. And Jack Welch did that. And I remember they had an 8-channel receiver. And I knew that he'd just begun to try to look for it. And he was on the telephone and hung it up and came down the hall to me with a yellow piece of paper with 8 numbers on it. And he said, "Look, it's there." What's it? And there was the peak in the middle of it. That was the water vapor line. That was W49.
So Jack Welch primarily was doing the dirty work, shall we say,
yes,
for the water.
Right.
And what about for the ammonia? Was that mainly Al Chung?
Yes.
I mean, obviously, Towns is behind all this.
Yes, yes.
Towns has been working on it for 2 or 3 years.
Yes, right.
Getting
things organized
on
that. Yes,
he came. In fact, these were amongst the first observations on the Happy 20.
The 20-foot, yes. It had just come into operation in the continuum, and Towns pushed this line work right away to everybody's joy, of course. He supplied people to help build things to do it, and money.
Yeah. Was he sort of instrumental in getting the antenna itself?
No, Jack Welch was the prime mover. And we had the antenna when he came. We just didn't have the line work going because it was, that wasn't so vital at first. Jack was particularly interested in planets and in continuum things, and he knew that the line development would be expensive and would take people.
Yeah.
So that, but Towns saying, "You must look here, it's worth the effort," is what brought that about. So it's a very neat way to begin observations with an antenna, two discoveries like that.
Well, thank you very much. Okay, tell me about the Bach era at Harvard.
That's a
he
long
was head
story.
Of the department.
No, he was head of the radio astronomy group there and was influential in getting Ed Lillian, in helping Ed Lillian and Dave Heeshan do the first observations of the 21-centimeter line there with the 24-foot antenna. And then he...
At Agassiz.
Yes, at the Agassiz. And he got the money for the 60-foot antenna to go on with that and gathered around a group of students who were inspired by his saying, "You have the biggest instrument in the world," which we did at that time. Dave Heeshan had graduated by that time, but he came back for a while. Coach Umanin was there, Tom Matthews, Mary Connolly Sandage, May Casson, Bill Howard, Frank Drake, Carlos Farsowski, and I. So we've spread abroad right. Since then. So Bach had a big influence.
I don't quite understand how Bach was head of a radio astronomy group. I mean, he's primarily an optical astronomer, isn't he?
He was, but he saw the importance of radio astronomy and 21 centimeters in particular. He's
right.
A galactic astronomer, and he looked upon this as a tool.
So this is sort of unusual. He's really, and maybe still, the only head of an astronomy place that didn't know much about electronics in some way.
Yes.
He was an astronomer.
That's right. And that I'm sure, made a difference, because then the problems at Harvard were directed not by the electronics that was feasible, but of course a very important factor in that was Doc Ewan, who had discovered the hydrogen line. He supplied the electronics know-how. Par excellence.
What was his position?
He wasn't, I don't know, it was some research connection with the observatory. It wasn't a position there. He had his own company and at UNITE and made the receiver there. And he saw the importance of frequency switching, and that's what the receiver did
right.
For scanning at that time.
So this was all 21 centimeter line work that they concentrated
yes.
on at this time.
Yes.
And the only other people doing it, well, there was the Dutch and the Australians that were doing things at this time.
That's not true.